From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A huge insider trading case has gone to trial this week in New York. Jury selection underway. Hedge fund billionaire Raj Rajaratnam stands accused of earning illegal millions off inside dope, non-public information on big corporations that would move markets with him out front. Some say this is just how the richest Americans invest on privileged information while the rest of the food chain trails behind trying to patch together a little 401k. This hour on Point, a crackdown on insider trading and fairness, justice in the U.S. financial system. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the prosecutor's case? What do you see on Wall Street? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer and columnist for The Wall Street Journal, author of The Greatest Trade Ever. Gregory Zuckerman, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here, Tom.
And with us from Philadelphia is Arthur Laby, associate professor at Rutgers Law School, specializes in securities law and regulation, spent nearly 10 years on the staff of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Arthur Laby, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So we've got pretty rough opening statements this week. U.S. Attorney Jonathan Streeter says greed and corruption, that's what this case is all about. $100 million bail, Gregory Zuckerman, that's not peanuts. Some people will know this inside and out if it's in their neck of the woods, in their business. Others may never have heard of the case at all. Tell us what's going on here, Gregory.
Sure. Well, Raj Rajaratnam is an interesting guy in Wall Street, a native of Sri Lanka, who joined an investment bank called Needham & Company in the early 90s. It was a hard-charging place, and he kind of led the pack in terms of gathering information as an investment banker. Then he left to start his own hedge fund, sort of a high-powered mutual fund, I would describe it, in the late 90s. And he's his whole MO, his whole strategy was gathering information, getting an edge. He pushed his employees to do that. It was an aggressive place. They traded very frequently, and they prided themselves in having the best information on Wall Street, often about technology companies. And now the accusation is they went too far gathering that information.
I mean, we're seeing allegations here that he had board members, I mean very prominent board members on big companies, Procter & Gamble, Goldman Sachs itself, calling him within, here's one instance accused, alleged, 23 seconds at the end of a board call, giving him a big heads up on where Goldman Sachs stock might be going.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In terms of Goldman, Warren Buffett was making an investment, and the allegation is that a board member, a very well-respected board member,
the former head of McKinsey, the consulting
exactly,
firm.
And also on the board of P&G, as you mentioned, and Goldman Sachs, he found out the information and immediately called Raj, who ended up making trade. And there's a tape, and this is the heart of the accusation, that they've got these tapes, wiretaps, which is why this case is so interesting and so tough for Raj, I would argue, that the tape says has Raj saying to a colleague that, quote, something good is going to happen for Goldman. And this is, again, just seconds after he got this phone call. Now, the Raj people have their arguments as to why that was just part of their mosaic. And on Wall Street, it's a common word. Well, I'm just creating a mosaic. I get all kinds of information. Not sure which is more important than other information, and it's not insider information.
You called the hedge funds high-powered mutual funds, and yet these are not the kind of mutual funds that most sort of normal-scale Americans typically just call up and put their money into.
That's true. Hedge funds are really for the wealthy, and that could be institutions or wealthy individuals. They invest for pension funds. They invest for charities and endowments. Most endowments are very heavily invested in hedge funds, but they also invest in – or in addition, they also invest in very wealthy investors. So, yes, it's not for you and not for me.
Arthur Laby, what do you see going on here? You know, the headlines – just in recent weeks, the big headlines have been sort of a nobody went to jail in the Wall Street meltdown and all the shenanigans that went on in advance of that after 2008. But now here are the prosecutors really coming down on a big head name in hedge funds and 19 of what, a couple of dozen already charged, convicted already at this point. What's going on with this push, Arthur?
Well, it's interesting. It is a little bit surprising to some that there's a recent emphasis on insider trading. Many expected the Department of Justice and the SEC to really go after the top executives at the big financial firms for their role in the financial crisis. We really haven't seen that, and I think that's because those cases are difficult. It's not clear that there were necessarily illegal acts that led to the financial crisis of 2008. By contrast, insider trading cases are much cleaner. They have a strong narrative. They have a good beginning and a middle and an end. They're easy to understand. The government gets a big payoff when it brings a big insider trading case. So in some respects, I'm not surprised that we do see both the SEC and the Department of Justice emphasizing insider trading cases in recent months.
Raj Rajaratnam is a big name and and admired for his success in many quarters. Are prosecutors here going after a real outlier, or are they just going after what has or had become just the way the game is played, Arthur?
Well, it's clear that the government is using very aggressive tactics. I wouldn't say for the first time, but that's one thing that's very interesting about this case. So as Gregory mentioned earlier, there are wiretapped phone conversations. That's usually a strategy that's reserved for organized crime. Very high-level witnesses, as you mentioned earlier, confidential informants in this case. It's really a fascinating case for those reasons, but for other reasons too, and I think this was part of your question. The case really exposes the darker side of hedge funds. So as we mentioned, until recently, hedge funds were unregulated private investment vehicles that were really for the wealthy. The rest of us could not invest in hedge funds. Now, for the first time, hedge funds are being exposed. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, advisors are going to have to register. There's going to be a new push to have some transparency to hedge funds. And this case very, I think, strongly exposes this alleged darker side of the world of hedge funds.
And Gregory, this is a world where it's anything, any last margin of information to get that return. Even the charges are here, illegal information. These are not small players, hedge funds. They may have been 20 years ago, but today they're big.
Hedge funds manage about $2 trillion today, and they use leverage. They use borrowed money, so they actually invest a lot more in the markets. And some corners of the market, they really dominate, things like convertible bonds, and they're really important in those areas. I think it's a little bit improper to kind of have this broad stroke approach to hedge funds. Some hedge funds are remarkably boring and have these steady eddy kind of returns and don't know anything about this kind of stuff. And it's also improper to say they haven't been regulated. They have been regulated. They can't do this stuff, but there's going to be more regulation going forward.
You've also said, though, that this case and the cases around it, because they're kind of building up to bigger fish here, show just how rampant this kind of wrongdoing, trading on insider information, has been.
Well, the question is, what is insider information? And frankly, it's a tough case for the government, and Arthur probably knows a lot more about this than I do, but it's a tough case for the government in general to bring an insider trading case. I mean, if you look back at the high-profile guys in the past, you think about Michael Milken, you think about Ivan Boesky, but the government really actually never won those convictions. They usually settle these convictions, high-profile cases. So this is a fascinating case because it does suggest that it is rampant. I would argue that there is some of this going on. There's probably too much of it going on. I'm not sure every firm is doing this, though.
Arthur, they're putting big teams of researchers in the field and giving them big incentives to go just as hard as they can after the information that will earn them a better return. Legally, where is the line? I mean, when you start digging in further and deeper and deeper and deeper on a corporation, how do you know when you've crossed into insider trading?
Well, it's a very, very tough case for the government, as Gregory points out. So a couple of things. First of all, Raj's defense, as mentioned, is that he wasn't trading on inside information. He legally collected bits and pieces of information to form a mosaic of high-quality research.
Right.
He used this mosaic to decide where to invest. That is what investment managers are supposed to do, arguably. His lawyers will argue that, indeed, he had a duty to go out and do due diligence and collect this information and analyze it. Now, under the law of insider trading, and I don't want to get too technical for your listeners, but there is a requirement that when somebody is tipped off, this tippee, that would be Raj, the receiver of the information, that then he takes on the same duty that his tipper had. But that's only true if, indeed, the tipper, the insider, breached a duty in disclosing information, and the TIPI, that is Raj, knows or should have known that there was a breach. And that's something that, that will remain to be seen during the course of the trial.
Is the fundamental line here about what's public information and what's not? I mean, if it's inside the company that the rest of the market doesn't have access to, it couldn't or shouldn't anyway, is that the line?
That's part of it. That's part of the line. That is to say, were these really bits and pieces of information that were public, and Raj and his terrific researchers were able to then put the information together in a mosaic and trade on the information that really was assembled through bits and pieces of public information. That's part of it. But the other point is, what was his knowledge? What did he know? And he is only guilty of insider trading if he knew or should have known that the individuals who gave him the information were breaching their duty in sharing it.
But when you've got a board member from Procter & Gamble or Goldman Sachs, both here, allegedly Rajat Gupta, the former head of McKinsey, the huge consulting firm, calling in one case just seconds after a board conference call, or in another instance, you know, letting him know that Warren Buffett, I guess, was going to put $5 billion into Goldman Sachs before anybody else knew that outside the board. That, is there any question about that?
I take your point, and as I said earlier, I think that it makes this a tough case all around. That's the one piece of information that everybody seems to be pointing to, that the press has picked up on it, and it will simply remain to be seen if they have a defense. That is, if Raj has a defense with respect to whether he knew that he was receiving non-public information and that Mr. Gupta should not have been sharing it at the time.
Gregory, I'm looking at your word here, rampant. I mean, is this just sort of par for the course? Is this the kind of information that hedge funds, big investors, have just come to trade on?
The goal of many hedge funds, not most, many hedge funds, is to get an edge. And they try to get all kinds of information, this kind of mosaic of information. And yes, some push the line. I would argue that it's a minority. It's too much of that's going on. And I would also argue that a lot of the attitude towards this stuff is changing on Wall Street. People are scared, and we could talk about that a little further.
We will indeed. Gregory Zuckerman, author of The Greatest Trade Ever, please stand by. And Arthur Leiby at Rutgers School of Law. Listeners, you can join us. Are you following the tale of Raj Rajaratnam and his Galleon Group, of the hedge fund billionaire and the insider trading charges against him? 800-423-TALK. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the biggest insider trading case in a generation, maybe in history, going to trial this week in New York, talking about justice and the U.S. financial system with Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer, columnist at The Wall Street Journal, author of The Greatest Trade Ever, about the case of John Paulson and his big haul. Arthur Leiby is with us from Philadelphia. He's at Rutgers School of Law, spent 10 years at the SEC. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you tracking this case? Is this how the big money in America stays on top unfairly with inside dope? Or does this look like the government hunting for a big scalp when they couldn't get one in the Wall Street meltdown? Is anybody tipping you off on Warren Buffett's next big move, calling you from just outside the boardroom? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And let's go right to our listeners. Loriana in Manhasset, New York. Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the show.
Thank you.
I just had a comment to share. I was recently at a social gathering where there were several of the young Wall Street guys there, and it was a pleasant evening until the conversation turned to insider trading, and my husband and I were really just beside ourselves with disgust by their admiration of the people who do this, saying it was a great way to retire early. You only get a couple of years in jail if you get caught. And I'm just wondering, where are the ethics? And this is cheating. And
Loriana, was it that out? I mean, were they calling it insider trading? Maybe they were talking about just hard, good, deep research.
Oh, no. It was insider trading. It's a great way to make money. They were trying to convince one other guy who was on Wall Street that, oh, yeah, you know, it gets a bad rap, but don't worry about it. You know, if you get caught, you probably get to keep your money anyway. Like, talking about it like it was a great thing to do.
Well, maybe $50 million, Raj Rajaratnam, out of his billion, or his defense attorney says less than a billion now. But that is big money. A couple years, I don't know, Gregory Zuckerman, what about the way this is kind of infected the culture of Wall Street in the high-flying end of it? Is it Is it that? I mean, have you heard that kind of jaunty conversation on this front?
That's disturbing. I have not heard that. I would argue those are kind of wannabe hedge fund types who see movies like Wall Street and kind of want to emulate those people. It's not to say it doesn't happen, but people are nervous on the street. You know what? There's an irony here in that a lot of what happens in terms of these accusations and subsequent ones, it's an expanding investigation. We could talk about that a little bit. But mm-hmm. a lot of it has resulted from this something called Reg FD, which is a good idea, which leveled the playing field. It was a rule that prohibited companies from sharing information. And this was rampant in the 80s and 90s for sure, sharing information with big investors. So if you have some good news, lots of times a big company back in the day would call up a big investor, be it a hedge fund or a mutual fund, and say, hey, this quarter is looking pretty good, and actual share numbers. And you can't do that anymore. So as a result of that, hedge funds and others had to come up with their own networks of information, and some do it legally by just digging and talking to suppliers and customers and that kind of thing. And I would argue most do that. But too many said, all right, we're going to try to get information in an improper way. So I do think it's disturbing when you hear that about that kind of stuff. I don't think it's rampant, but it's way too prevalent.
What do you know, Gregory, about what it was like to work at Galleon Group, Rajarajaratnam's place, when he was flying high and doing these deals?
They were among the biggest investors in technology and some other areas. They managed about $7 billion at their peak, and it was a high-charging place, very pressured. If you come a few minutes late to a morning meeting, Raj would have reprimanded you and fined you, and you were pushed. You had to get information that others didn't have on Wall Street, and that's not so easy. I'm not going to argue it's an efficient market, but it's a relatively efficient market, and to come up with that kind of information, you have to be pretty aggressive, and you have to have all kinds of sources, and people would come up to him throughout the day giving Raj pieces of information. Mm-hmm. In some ways, he was at the center of a network, and now we really see what kind of network it was. It was all kinds of executives, former executives, and his own traders were encouraged to develop their own networks of information like that.
Arthur, are you expecting that the prosecution here will say that in effect he was pushing them to bring him insider information, whether he explicitly said that or not, with that high-pressure environment?
I think that is a part of the high-pressure environment. The government will certainly argue that the incentives were there, and even if Mr. Rajaratnam carefully stepped aside and didn't use the language of insider trading or inside information, mm-hmm. that the incentives are incredibly strong to bring back information that's non-public and get an edge. The other point I wanted to add is that I think your caller, Lariana, tapped into something quite important with respect to the symbolism of the case and the edge that the government will try to argue the hedge funds try to obtain. The case involves, as we've said, a group mm-hmm. of technology and hedge fund executives that the government says symbolizes an entire culture of insider trading on Wall Street. And this is a new push, I think, by the SEC, who's much more aggressive after the Madoff scandal and the financial crisis of 2008, to crack down. And it's this culture of insider trading on Wall Street that I think they want to demonstrate that they are attacking very aggressively.
And it allegedly worked for everybody inside that golden, that platinum circle or culture. I mean, they're talking about here about another guy, Anil Kumar, former senior partner and director at McKinsey, the huge consulting firm again, who was sort of chipping in, the government says, alleges, inside information over several years, and that Rajaratnam was putting money in an overseas account of his housekeeper, sort of on a regular basis in return for doing that, until he brought him something so big, so juicy, that he got a $1 million bonus tip for that. I mean, this is big money for the tippers too, Arthur.
Absolutely. I mean, look, the from what we all are reading in the papers, the evidence of the case is quite strong, and the risks are extremely high of going to trial in this case. I mean, as we've said, there's a 20-year risk of a prison sentence. The SEC.
It's at trial, right? That's what they're doing right now. Could he still plead out even now?
Highly unlikely. Mm-hmm. One can always plead, but the time to plead was a long, long time ago when the case is first brought. The benefits of pleading once that initial period has passed are mm-hmm. very slim, mm-hmm. very small.
And why criminal charges this time? The government's tactics seem to be changing here.
Well, that's a great question. So the SEC itself is not a criminal agency. It cannot bring a criminal case. Indeed, the recent case against Rajiv Gupta is not a criminal case. It's an administrative case.
This is the guy who was head of McKinsey and who's allegedly involved in this as well, but not criminal, civil in that case. Of course, he denies everything.
Exactly right. It's just an allegation, mm-hmm. and it's not brought criminally. It's only brought civilly. And the big question is, when do cases go criminal? When does the SEC refer the case to the Department of Justice and try to have them take up the mantle with a criminal matter? Of course, for the SEC, that's always a positive development, right? They would like to show that insider trading is a very serious crime, and they are quite pleased when they can convince their colleagues at the Department of Justice to take up the case. And indeed, as you know, we now have a head of the director of the Division of Enforcement at the SEC who is a former criminal prosecutor, not simply a former lawyer, Wall Street lawyer, but also he was that, but he's also a former prosecutor, and I think he will be pushing hard to have more criminal cases in the insider trading area in particular.
I want to talk about the possible effect of that and how much weight the public should put on that. But let's get another call here. Boston, Bob is calling. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a complex game that they're playing with these hedge funds. It's almost a rigged game.
Rigged by whom? In what direction, Bob?
But there was no real oversight by the government. Previous administration defanged SEC. There was never anybody going after these people. And what the public can't follow, they can't really keep in check. So with no government oversight and no consequences for these actions, there's a contempt that I've picked up upon with friends of mine who are in the hedge fund field. Some of them run hedge funds. A contempt for the public and for the government because the game is no longer as rigged as it was, perhaps. Maybe rigged's not the best word, but you get my idea.
You mean a contempt because they have felt free just to follow the buck by any means?
Yes. Many of them have. I wish we taught ethics again back at the business schools because that is so desperately needed, and there seems to be none. And your previous caller alluded to listening to people having these same attitudes at big parties.
Lorient,
there are a lot of wannabes that are bragging, but there are also a lot of these leaders who don't, these hedge fund managers, that feel that they should have everyone come to them. It's a contempt for the public and for, and there, if you look at the wealth distribution, it shows right there on the paper.
Yeah, it's right there. I appreciate your call, Bob. Arthur, I mean, is this just what happens when you get two tiers so far apart in terms of wealth that one just doesn't believe it plays by the rules of the other anymore? Is that where we've been?
Well, that does tap into another fascinating development. So until very recently, hedge funds themselves were, let's say, lightly regulated. That is, the hedge fund, the pool of money, did not have to register like a mutual fund does, and the advisors to those pools did not have to register with the SEC as an investment advisor. Mm-hmm. So they managed under the law, quite legally, to escape regulation on both levels. That has now changed. The SEC tried to regulate the advisors. They were shot down in the courts, but the Dodd-Frank Act changed that, and now these hedge fund advisors will be required to register with the SEC, and that's significant. That means that the commission staff can go out around the country, knock on the door to the hedge fund advisors, do a comprehensive inspection and examination of the firm, talk in quite detail with the hedge fund advisors, try to find out how it is that they're making their money, what kind of investing they're doing, who their clients are, and that's a sea change with respect to the regulation of hedge funds.
Gregory, have you witnessed the kind of culture of contempt in some of these circles that our caller Bob is talking about there for the public, for the government, for, I don't know, the pitiful government or the little people?
I think there's resentment. I'm not sure I'd call it contempt.
Resentment? They're billionaires.
Resentment to the point that they are subject to more scrutiny, and they think the people coming in and examining their books don't know anything about their business. Sometimes these are kind of sophisticated trading methods. But I would make a larger, maybe more encouraging argument to the audience in that what we're mostly seeing, other than Raj, is small potato kind of small fry hedge fund types who are getting caught up in this net. And Raj is interesting because he's a larger guy. But what I'm seeing is the largest hedge funds are actually getting more boring. They don't allow their own employees to check various websites at the office or sometimes even email to the outside. They're scared about prosecution. The returns have come down. I mean, the average hedge fund was up 10% last year. Mm-hmm. My mutual funds and your mutual funds, the average mutual fund, were up 15% last year. So I think it's a little too much to make this argument that, well, hedge funds are making all these profits and breaking the law. They've actually realized that there's more profit to be made by being more boring and registering with the SEC and looking like a staid kind of more boring institution. So I think this does happen. I think it's kind of smaller hedge funds that are pushing the envelope, and that's why Raj really stands out, because it was a larger firm.
Are you so sure about that? Is this the end of the line? Is Raj, you know, the big fish, and then it's all the little stuff from there? Or may we be building up to more, bigger, Gregory?
Well, I think this investigation is expanding, and we've reported this, and we've got intelligence suggesting that, yes, this investigation has expanded to something called expert networks, which is what a lot of hedge funds and others hired, these kind of people that networks of employees at companies, and they supply information. But the hedge funds that have been caught up in these investigations, and I think going forward perhaps as well will be, often are not the kind of big-name firms. In some ways, this is a throwback sort of old-school case. I would argue that a lot of the improper trading perhaps is high frequency, these technology oriented trading firms that often jump in and jump out really quickly. And the old school picking up the phone and getting a call doesn't happen as much as it used to. And if you think about the 80s and the prosecution of investment bankers often for leaking things to Boesky and others, investment bankers really haven't been tagged over the past couple decades, major investment bankers, for major abuses. So likewise, I hope, I'm not saying I'm sure, I'm hoping that hedge funds will learn this lesson and be scared for a decade or two before, you know, they go back to the way they used to do it.
Larry in Burlington, Vermont. Larry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Some great points. The one that I worry about is how strong is our enforcement? We have lots of regulations and laws on the books, and the SEC clearly tries. But to go after what I would call a smaller fish and let a Rajagupta off on an administrative level implies they either don't have enough on the guy, or they're being bought out, you know, by the big guys. They don't want to put anybody big in jail. They just want to scare people. Is it a lack of SEC strength and insider their own tentacles? Are they not getting enough insider information, or is the system still a little gamed?
Good question, Arthur Levy. I mean, Rajagupta, head of McKinsey, that's as big as it gets in sort of the American business world.
That's as big as it gets. And it was very surprising to many that the case was brought. In fact, it wasn't even brought in federal district court by the SEC. It was brought in something called an administrative proceeding, which means it's before an administrative law judge, an in-house judge at the SEC, which is in some respects not even as significant as a federal court action.
Is that because they didn't have the goods, or are they bowing to his stature?
Right. So what's going on there? That's the question. And I think one a possibility, and I alluded to this earlier, is that these cases, these insider trading cases, are very difficult. One needs to show that the tipper, that is in this case Mr. Gupta, that he obtained some sort of personal benefit. It does not have to be a cash benefit, but some benefit from tipping somebody else off to information.
Didn't he run some fund for Galleon Group? Or wasn't he kind of in the biz?
Well, that's that. So kind of in the biz is want to clarify it. But as a legal matter, it may not be the case that it's clear cut that Mr. Gupta received a benefit. So to the extent that the information that was shared wasn't necessarily illegal, not surprising that you don't see a criminal case here where the standards of proof are much, much stronger than in a non-criminal case.
But Gregory, just yesterday, it was the Assistant U.S. Attorney, Jonathan Streeter, and he's telling the jurors in this case about tapes that they're going to hear in the process of the trial. And he says that they're going to hear Rajaratnam himself saying, quote, "I heard yesterday from somebody who's on the board of Goldman Sachs that they're going to lose $2 a share," telling employees this. I mean, isn't that the definition of insider information, insider trading?
The educated opinion among legal experts and on Wall Street is that it's a really good case for the government.
And wasn't Gupta the guy on the board?
Yes. And this is right. You're pointing to an interesting point. It's not just sort of a mosaic of interesting information that he cobbled together. This is pretty specific information. So, yeah, it's a good case. It's a strong case. And I would also address the last caller. I kind of agree. The SEC has been somewhat toothless in recent years. It was afraid of, I would argue, taking on big cases. So it's a crucial case for the SEC and for regulators in general in that they, if they win this thing, then it gives encouragement to take on other ones, other big name cases. And if they lose it, it does discourage them to some extent.
Wow, what a case. We're going to come back and look at more of the really gripping details of this insider trading case getting underway, the trial getting underway this week in New York with Gregory Zuckerman of The Wall Street Journal and Arthur Laby at Rutgers School of Law, formerly with the SEC. You can join us. What do you hear in the details of this alleged insider trading? Have we been too lax in enforcing fairness? And why? And is this a sideshow while the bankers who crunched Wall Street walk free? Is it important anyway? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. All kinds of response here. We've got BHA in Vermont says, I like this. Take everything he has. Put him in the soup kitchen for 20 years. But here's another that says, you know, the defense has a good case here. 800-423-8255. What do you think? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biggest insider trading case in a generation, maybe in history, going to trial this week in New York, looking at justice, fairness, and the U.S. financial system. You can join us at 800-423-8255. The case of Rajaratnam before the court in New York, before the jury in New York now, and his Galleon Group with pretty tough evidence, though we'll see how it goes down. His defense attorney says that he was putting together a mosaic of information. But some of it, the prosecution says, came from straight inside the boardrooms at the very kind of top of the American economy here, sometimes at least once within seconds of it being shared there. 800-423-8255. Arthur Laby is with us from Rutgers School of Law. He was for 10 years with the SEC. Gregory Zuckerman is here, author of The Greatest Trade Ever, senior writer at The Wall Street Journal. And Gregory, Arthur, we've got all kinds of response online. Really, boy, we have smart listeners. Here's Matt, and he says, this case reaches far into the boardrooms of elite Fortune 100 companies. It would be hard to overstate, and he's right, how highly regarded and MBA certified are some of the people implicated. Consider Rajat Gupta, head of management consulting and former head, Don of sort of nationally of management consulting, former head of McKinsey, who is alleged to have provided tips to Rajaratnam. Could this finally reveal, Matt asks, some of the systematic ethical collapses that have taken place at the very highest level of American corporations? And hold Matt's thought, if you would, Arthur and Greg, because here's another from Carol. She says, my father, Blair Benson, won an Emmy for developing videotape. I remember as a small child his telling us he wished he could buy stock in Sony, but he couldn't because he had insider information. She says, I teach management classes and tell this story. Students ask if my father was nuts. This is the problem in the U.S. today. I mean, here's her father, no big corporate giant. He knew things. He did not act on them. On the other hand, we got the guy who was the head of McKinsey, allegedly sharing information straight out of a boardroom. Is that the ethical collapse, Arthur, that our listener Matt asks about?
Well, I think the focus on ethics is exactly right. And one thing the SEC has tried to do over the past many years is instill an ethical culture within all firms, whether it's broker-dealers, investment advisors. You may be interested.
What grade
to
do you
know.
Give them on that over these recent years, for heaven's sakes?
Well, for the vast majority of firms, I think they get at least an A-minus, if not an A. But, of course, there are many firms that don't take ethics seriously, and we would unfortunately have to fail them. When one becomes a registered advisor with the SEC, then some of the rules have more teeth. So those firms have to have an ethics policy. They have to enforce that ethics policy on the ground, and the SEC can go in, do its inspection, and find out if the firm is really not only has the ethics rules up on the shelf, but if they're actually implementing them. And I think that what your web audience is demonstrating is that this culture of ethics, it's really what the public wants to see. And unfortunately, in some firms, hopefully a small number of firms, it's very sorely lacking. I think the vast majority of firms act in an ethical manner and step aside when they have a material non-public information and refrain from trading.
And we salute all those that do, but there's an awful lot of money concentrated in a pretty few hands here, Gregory. I mean, here's another listener, Loe, says, quoting from the Financial Times, this is just a few days ago, the top 10 hedge funds made $28 billion for clients in the second half of last year, $2 billion more than the net profits of Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, and HSBC combined. I mean, it doesn't take many firms.
Is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, I don't know. But when you get a case like this with such a prominent hedge fund guy out there doing what we're told here, if you're a regular Joe in the street who's supposed to put your money in here to save for retirement, maybe even instead of Social Security, you got to scratch your head and ask that question.
Yeah, it's disturbing. I mean, I'm not sure how you measure ethics. I know we all have a view that things are getting worse in this country. I would kind of cite instances of rampant insider trading back in the 1800s, early 1900s, and obviously there was much more bias
the
in
Gilded
the workplace.
Age.
Yes, for some. And, you know, obviously there was much more bias in the workplace just a couple decades mm-hmm. ago. So in some ways, ethics are better today. But you could argue, I do think there are too many smart people working, too many smart, capable people coming onto Wall Street and thinking that I'm going to trade and make money as opposed to becoming engineers or doctors and doing something that actually adds a little bit more, I would argue, to society. So to that extent, if you want to argue that there are ethics and that's troubling, I would agree with that.
Well, I mean, but Arthur, we're in an economy where for the last, 15, 20 years, people increasingly are told to save for whatever they need to save for in life, retirement, take your 401k and get it into very likely into the stock market. Now, if that's being played right up at the very top, isn't that a fundamental problem in a country where that's supposed to be the way for little people, ordinary people, to, you know, have some kind of financial security?
Well, it's a fundamental problem, and there's no question that the SEC understands that, as does the Department of Justice, and they are looking hard to make the push against insider trading. Look, it certainly behooves all of us, not only the SEC, but our entire government and the entire country to have a market where investors are confident that they can invest and there's not a game that is being played by the individuals at the top. The question is, how significant is it? Of course, we can't really look back to the 1800s or earlier because back in that day, insider trading was not illegal. Mm. Right? It was not necessarily wrong. It was
and
rampant,
most people weren't in the stock market. But now we've been herded there.
Absolutely. And there's no question that we want, like every country does, we want safe and secure markets. We want to have that level of confidence. And of course, insider trading is highly illegal. That in and of itself is controversial, but it is. And so the SEC and the Justice Department, they want to make sure that the public knows that they are the cop on the beat. And to the extent that they can get a conviction here, as I say, it's quite mm-hmm. symbolic. There was actually a case that the government lost. And Gregory is, I think, probably quite familiar with this also. There were two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers,
right.
Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tannen, and the government lost that case. So here, in order to instill confidence in the markets, there's no question that this is a high-stakes game. And if the government has another loss here, that's going to be a real blow, I think the government feels, to public confidence in the securities markets.
Let me get a call from
Tom,
Gregory,
please.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, I also think it's worth raising the question as to whether individuals get hurt. I don't necessarily subscribe to the view, but there's a conservative view that we need more information, more efficient markets, and by preventing insiders from buying and selling, you actually hurt the individual investor because they end up buying stocks that are too high or too low because all information isn't priced into the stocks. Now, I would argue that if it was rampant back like it was back in the day, then it would undermine confidence in markets, and that wouldn't do good for you or me.
But come on, you and I are both investing, and I'm told Warren Buffett is coming with $5 billion, and you're not. Can that be a good thing? Is that fair?
I hear you, but what about the guy that buys the shares at a price that is too high or too low because no one has been trading this on insider frame information? So
you're
he
for
gets hurt
insider
also.
Trading.
And, no, I'm raising that conservative viewpoint, which is an interesting one. Again, I don't agree with it myself, but it's worth considering. If you buy a stock a week before it reports really bad earnings and the stock goes down by 20%, you've gotten crushed. And had you bought the stock and that information had been slipping into the market, you would have bought the stock at a much lower price.
Yeah, but how
price.
Far does it slip? Why should the gang with billions, you know, be so advantaged over me? We're all in the same stock market here. Now, I know I don't have a whole squad of researchers working for me. There are inequities that are unavoidable, and most people seem willing to accept those. I mean, how are you going to get around it? But here, when they're getting information right out of the boardroom, are you kidding me? That can be good for the economy? You know, that can be fair?
Well, I think we're conflating two issues. There's the resentment we all have at the big shots,
I don't think Americans resented that when it was considered that when it seemed like it was running fairly. It's not Americans aren't against wealth just on its face, but if you get sort of a privileged set where this is, I think the word you used was rampant, and others on the outside looking in, and that's supposed to be the arena in which they secure a future for their children, for themselves. That's supposed to be all right?
Listen, I'm not defending insider trading. I think it's improper and it's against the law. I'm just saying that it's not as clear-cut situation as to why the individual investor gets hurt. Again, if I buy a stock and then the earnings collapse and the earnings report comes out a few weeks later, I bought the stock much too high a price, and I would have paid a lot less had there been insiders who were selling ahead of that. But again, I don't believe in undermining the confidence in the market.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily resent others because they've done things that they shouldn't have done. I think eventually the law will catch up with them, and we're seeing that here. And I think this is a tribute to the justice for taking this case. It's an aggressive case, but it's not such a layup, so we'll see if hopefully they can win this.
Let's go to Hank in Boston. Hank, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Greg, good morning. You know me very well, and I'm sorry we haven't caught up for a while. I have some concerns and some questions. First of all, Arthur, I disagree with your point about the culture in these firms. Having been in the M&A business during the 1980s and 1990s, particularly during the 80s, the culture was very strict, and people stayed away from it. The converse of the problem was that people were frankly afraid to report it because they thought that they would get fired by their firms, and there was a lot that went on in the background, particularly in offshore trading.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not confident that today's regulations do anything.
You mean Dodd-Frank, the new legislation since the meltdown?
Correct. I think it really does nothing on the problem. I think it's a check-in-the-mail promise that says we're doing something, but frankly, I don't think anything's really being done. I am, as Greg knows, an incredible skeptic on the law, and I am very concerned. I am also recall back during the 80s where we were in major deals, the last person we contacted were governmental authorities about the announcements of major deals because we were afraid that there would be insider trading that came out of Washington. And therefore, we waited until the 11th hour to tell regulators, particularly at the Federal Trade Commission, because we were afraid of leaks.
So, Hank, what's the problem that you're overall concerned about here, that the market is riddled with this kind of insider information trading?
It is riddled. It has been for many years. It is easy to do, particularly with offshore accounts. I think there's no regulation. I think there need to be many more lawsuits, not just these sort of figurehead lawsuits, and far more granular enforcement.
What about the argument that pretty or not, this helps for the overall efficiency of the market when the information moves and you know, markets respond to it, pretty or not?
You know, I think that informational efficiency itself is a little bit of a fantasy. And there are always going to be people who are following the market close enough and better informed than other people. That is just a characteristic of most any market. But I do think that there needs to be a greater effort to level the playing field. I have to agree with Greg that it's very difficult to quantify hurt as the small investor being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I find that difficult because having watched this go on, there is the only fear is not that I'm hurting the small investor, but that I might get caught. I teach. I'm a professor now at a famous business school
Yep.
in the Northeast, in
mm-hmm.
Boston.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I tell my students is if you are going to insider trade, do it big. And you make the judgment as to why you're doing it, whether you're going to do it, and how you're going to do it, and what the consequences may be. Don't try to make a few $100,000, make 20, 30, 40 million if you're going to do it and get caught.
But Hank, is that the same argument that Loriana, right off the bat in this hour, the caller heard at the cocktail party, you know, hey, you'll make
it's
your...
against the law.
But you'll serve a couple of years, but you'll have 50 million.
Well, that's it. If you add up the days that people like Milken and Dennis Levine and Marty Siegel spent, all my buddies spent in Club Fed, and then the money they walked away with in many of the cases, it was worth at least a couple hundred thousand dollars a day of them being paid to stay in Club Fed.
Hank, I really appreciate your call and your perspective. Gregory Zuckerman, there's somebody speaking to you.
No, well, I don't agree with that. I think violating any law in this country is improper. I would never encourage that whatsoever.
It's not about impropriety. We're describing you got $50 million, you do 2 years, maybe it's worth it.
It's hard for me to judge whether it's worth the people. I would never advise violating the law. You know, it's a scar on your family, scar on your kids, and I don't think any of us should be envious of people who served time in prison. So
heavens,
no,
but you hear what Hank's saying. I mean, that's kind of, you know... He's telling his students, you know, if you're going to do it big, boys, girls.
It's troubling. It's troubling. I don't think that's the par for the course. I think there are, you know, in this country, there are many more courses on ethics in business schools. There was nothing a decade or two ago. I know professors who teach them right now.
And Arthur, to the point that there are still not the teeth out there to actually get this done, stop this.
Well, as a preliminary matter, let me just say that I actually hope the caller was kidding. I tell my students that they should not ever perform a cost-benefit analysis when it comes to violating the law. They may disagree with the law, but if this was the judgment of our country that something is illegal, then they follow the law to the T and certainly not make a cost-benefit analysis and say, gee, I might get away with it, so why don't I go ahead and try it? And that's the way I want to act and raise my children. As to the question of the teeth, sure, what the caller is saying, I think, cuts a couple of ways. Some people say, gee, we can't do anything about it, so the SEC is not helpful. We shouldn't give them resources because they're failing anyway. I think the better view is that, and the caller, I think, mentioned this, we need a lot more resources being pumped into the SEC. We need more cases to be brought if we're really going to instill a confidence in the markets. It's a relatively small agency. Our markets have grown by leaps and bounds over the past 20 or 30 years. And indeed, we need a much larger SEC and more expertise on the ground in the agency.
And Arthur, we just got a minute, but what about the point that many are making here online and Facebook that, you know, this is in a way the wrong target, that we just went through this huge financial crisis, millions driven into real financial problem by it, hundreds of billions destroyed, and nobody went to jail from the major banks and financial companies on Wall Street, except Bernie Madoff. But is this the wrong target?
Well, that is a very serious concern, and many people have raised it. And as I mentioned, I think that the government would very much like to find a couple of great cases against individuals who were responsible for the financial crisis of 2008. But you know what? If they weren't necessarily violating the law and that case is not there, you cannot bring the case unless you're pretty sure you're going to win it. By contrast, insider trading cases are, I'll say, relatively clear-cut. And the SEC and the Department of Justice, I think appropriately, are going after those individuals where they can win a case.
Do you think prosecutors will win this one with Raj Rajaratnam, Galleon Group? How do they look? How do they feel?
It's very hard to predict what a jury will do, but I think there's a very strong case. And let me just add that the statistics are in the government's favor. So although we mentioned earlier one big case that was lost, they win 90% of their cases, and they won three big cases in recent years. And we haven't had time to talk about those. But I think as a result, the statistics lean in favor of the government.
Well, this will be one to watch. Arthur Leiby at Rutgers School of Law. Thank you so much for being with us from Philadelphia today, Arthur.
Thanks for having me.
And Gregory Zuckerman, author of The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Gregory, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Listeners, thanks for your comments, your calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.